trying to decide if the serpent on the cover is how Hob imagined the serpents, or if it's...
Cover art is almost never what the author imagines, because usually the publisher hires somebody to do it, and it's usually before... It's because of deadlines and stuff, they usually haven't read everything. That's why some, you know, covers are so weird compared to the book. Like the old Wheel of Time books, there are not four people who leave the original village. There's five, because that was in the original draft, an idea. And then it was cut. So the art stayed in like it was.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. No, I don't know. I guess, I mean, not that I don't pay attention to cover art, but I kind of don't pay attention to cover art, I guess.
You don't judge books by their cover?
Oh, no, I absolutely do that. But I don't really think about the covers outside of after I've read them, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, because usually I'm not spending so much time on a book and seeing the cover over and over and over again.
Welcome back to another episode of Is Fitz Happy. I'm Luke.
And I'm Emma. And I foresee that this chapter is chapter 34 and called Oracle.
I like how you had to look down at your book to remember that.
No, see, now you've ruined the movie magic.
Yes. You definitely had all of our listeners fooled, Emma. You definitely predicted what we were going to do next in our weekly chapter series. But yes, this is chapter 34. This is called Oracle. And this is the chapter where Kennet and Adda bring Wintrow to other island.
Yes. This is a time jump, which we haven't had in a bit.
Months have passed, actually. Yeah,
because they have traveled from Divitown to other island. They are currently stationed in the little safe alcove.
Yeah. And when they left Divitown, there were already buildings up. There was a watchtower that was wooden that was already manned with the stone starting to be built around it.
Right.
And Wintrow is still feeling the effects of his injuries from Divitown battle, but most other people have healed. So right. It's kind of, you know, his arm probably isn't broken anymore, but he's still not 100%.
True. But he does say that he tries to get rid of the thought that the reason his hurt longer was from the pain of killing the man who dealt the blow, but he puts that out of his head as a silly superstition.
Yeah. I do want to read a passage before we get into other island here. He is right now kind of laying down with a shirt wrapped around his head, kind of lounging near Vivacia, I think. Mm-hmm. And it says that he rolled over onto his back. Even through the shirt and his eyelids, the light danced on his eyeballs. Sometimes it seemed he could see things in the patterns. He clenched his eyelids, and green flashes snaked across his visions like darting serpents. He loosened his eyes, and the color became paler and took the shape of sunbursts. Interesting, interesting turns of phrase there, Hob.
So, do you think that that little burst of color is that prophecy from Vivacia or just a coincidence?
I don't think it's anything more than a clever description to foreshadow things.
Okay.
Or linking it to his past.
Okay. Interesting. I'll come back to what I think.
Okay. Because as it's described, all he's doing is seeing the light from the sun.
Right.
So,
yeah,
we'll come back to it. But as I mentioned before, Wintrow says that it has been a handful of months. It is now past high summer. They are kind of crawling towards autumn now. And Wintrow says when they had left Divitown, half a dozen motley structures constructed of wood old and new had already risen from the ashes. A wooden tower as tall as a ship's mast was already manned, while one of stone took slow shape around it. The folk there called Kennet King. It was a term of affection as much as title. Ask the king, they would advise one another, and nod to the tall, peg-legged man with a scroll of papers always tucked under his arm. Their last sight of Divytown had been the raven flag flapping boldly from the flagstaff atop the tower. Here to stay was embroidered beneath the bird's outstretched wing and rapacious beak. And as you mentioned, Emma, they are now anchored outside of Other Island.
Yeah. Also, I do want to just quick say, I think it's pretty sick to have a motto of
here to stay.
Here to stay on a place that is a pirate transient town where they have recently been attacked by slavers. That's like,
yeah,
pretty cool. Pretty cool.
I mean, that's what Kennet convinced them to do. Well, Wintrow convinced them to do.
True. I mean, if Kennet has one thing going for him, it's that he has style. We cannot not give him credit.
So Vivacia's anchored kind of close. Marietta is anchored further away. And they are, they meaning Etta, Kennet, and Wintrow, are going to shore with a couple other people in a rowboat, but they're kind of staying, you know, on Other Island's beach with the rowboat when Kennet and Wintrow and Etta will be ready to leave. They'll go back and then go back to Vivacia.
Right.
Before they get into the rowboat and go onto the island, before Wintrow is called up, he's still lounging by Vivacia right now. And she has some feelings about the island. They are anchored. They just haven't left yet. And she says, I do not like being here. Wintrow sighed. Neither do I. Some find them exciting, but I have always feared omens' importance. At the monastery, some of the acolytes would play with crystals and seeds, casting them out and reading what they foretold. The priests tolerated it, more or less. A few were amused by it, saying we would learn better as we grew. At least one said we'd be better off playing with knives. My instincts led me to agree with him. All of us stand on the edge of the future. Why venture off the precipice? I believe there are true oracles who can peer ahead and see what where one is destined to tread, but I also think that there is a danger in... Not that, the ship said sharply. I know nothing of that. I remember this place. I remember this place, but I know I've never been here. Wintrow, is it your memory? Have you been here before? Wintrow says, I haven't, but perhaps Kennet has, and Vivacia's like, no, I know Kennet's memories, because I can recall that as a man. But when I was last in these waters, I slipped through them, swift and sleek. I was new and young. I began here, Wintrow. I began here, not once, but many times. So she's recalling her distant dragon memories of being born on this island and starting life anew.
Yeah. Also, though, why'd she even bother asking Wintrow if it was his memories?
Trying to find any sort of comfort or confirmation that it was not hers.
I guess. But it's odd that then she couldn't just pretend like it was Kennet if that was the kind of comfort she wanted. I guess. Like, I don't know.
Okay. Just bothered by it? Or?
Yeah, yeah. I think it just, she's like, is it your memory? And Wintrow's like, well, no, but it could be Kennet. She's like, it's not Kennet's. Okay, well, why'd you ask? I know the difference between the memory of a man and my memory. Well, do you? Because you just asked Wintrow if it was his memory. So, I don't know. I'm just salty with Vivacia right now, and Wintrow for that matter.
Well, Vivacia is not helped by Wintrow's thoughts there, and he can tell that she's troubled. He reaches towards her and kind of feels around the memories that she's thinking of and sees them as she does. Wings against the sun, sliding deep water images framed in green light. These were the images of his deepest sleep, fever shapes too bright and hard to meet the light of day. He tried to mask his uneasiness. How could you begin many times? He asked her gently. And she replies, it's all a circle. A circle that turns. Nothing stops, nothing is lost, and it all goes spiraling on like a thread of spool.
I have a question about this, because I think this is a theme throughout the series, that there is this wheel of time, but there is a circle of time that is continuous and it's a cycle. Do you think that means that people outside of dragons are also being reborn? Or is this simply dragons are special? They get to keep their memories. And it's not necessarily that they're being reborn. They just have their ancestors' memories with them.
Yeah, it's something like that. Because they never really truly die unless they're killed, right? Or do they?
I don't know, because then their memories live on if they're eaten by their kin.
Yeah.
So.
Dragons seem to be special in that case. I don't really know the metaphysical parts of humans because it's never really discussed.
Although we do see last trilogy where Fitz and Fool stand in that one particular spot and are taken back to a different iteration of Catalyst and White Prophet. And.
But that's because it's a skill stone pillar, and that is a memory from that time imbued with that magic. Similar to like Kelsingra has right. All those memories around that. It's not necessarily that they were reborn or anything. Not necessarily. It could be, but.
Okay. Well, then I think I'm going to make the hard call that. At least my personal belief now is that dragons aren't actually being reborn. They just have their ancestors' memories.
Right.
And it's makes like sense. Getting lost in the skill pillars, like when Rapskull decides he is whatever that guy's name is. It's the general.
Teletor.
Yeah. When he decides that, I feel like that's the same thing happening with the dragons, where it's this cycle of, oh, I know you and I know everything because I've had so many iterations of memories into my life that's just who I am now. I don't know. So that's what I'm going to choose to believe, that dragons do not have endless life cycles. It's just because they can recall memory.
Yeah.
And that would make sense as to why when the Fool connected with an ancestor, because presumably all the whites are related, right? In some way. But whenever he connected through the skill to his ancestor, that would make sense why he was like, that was me. That was just like a different version of me. Because I distinctly remember there being a passage of the Fool saying, that was us a long time ago. Like, we're back. And Fitz is like, nah, that's not me. So that would make more sense. Again, with like skill, somebody else's memory, if you take that on as your own. I don't know.
Yeah.
New tinfoil hat theory.
So you think just catalysts and prophets, or just dragons and humans are kind of out of it, or whites are included in that?
No, I think anybody could potentially have memories of past people.
Okay.
I think the reason dragons think that they are everlasting is because they have so many memories that they equate that to being themselves.
Right.
When it's actually their parents.
The question more so is about the humans, though, I'm asking.
Oh, okay.
Because that was your kind of question, too, is what about the souls of humans? Like, are people just reborn in this universe? So what do you think about humans?
No, I don't think anything is reborn. I don't think there's...
Yeah.
There's no redoing of a life cycle.
Yeah.
They can just also take somebody else's memories and choose to believe that that is themselves. However, not necessarily true.
It also takes a lot more for humans to remember those other memories.
And I think humans have less capacity for the memories. That's why people get stuck in the skill or whatever, the madness that happens.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Etta breaks through the reverie there that they're kind of in and says it's time to go.
And as Wintrow leaves, he assures Vivacia it will be all right. But despite his reservations, his heart is beating faster and he's excited to go.
Mm-hmm. And we jump over to Kenneth's point of view, who, as I explained, is in a rowboat with Etta and Wintrow and a couple of their sailors, and they're going to other island right now. And he is watching Wintrow's face and can tell that Wintrow isn't 100% fully healed, but he's not complaining, so Kenneth thinks he's a good lad and he's doing well for not complaining. And he also talks about kind of the state of his crew, what's kind of going on with Divytown and Marietta and his other mates. So he has a new mate, Jola, that was left in charge of Vivacia, kind of charged that mate to be like, hey, you're in charge unless the ship thinks otherwise. And then follow the ship's instructions. And in his head, Kenneth is hoping he can trust Jola more, and he proves himself that he's more trustworthy. And he is sad to see Brig go, who was the former first mate after Sorcor left. Brig was one of the ones in charge of the captured slave ship with Wintrow and Saadar. I remember that with because Wintrow went to Brig to talk about Saadar.
Right. Yeah.
So Brig finally got his own ship. Kenneth is talking about like, yep, it was about time. He's had enough experience. He's grown. He raised a ship out of the Divytown harbor that had sunk and gave him a hefty chunk of money to fix it up and everything like that, and picked people from Divytown to help crew it so they wouldn't be tempted to run away.
And most interestingly to me, he picked men and women.
Yep.
Which I kind of found very progressive of Kenneth. But it just felt like
men and women with family in Divytown.
Yes, yeah. Specifically they had to have family. But I thought it was interesting because he seemed so anti, like, women on board. He's been grown to it, I think. Yeah, I don't think he necessarily cares, but he doesn't like the idea of distraction on board boats,
yeah, I guess. That's exactly what I was going to think, too. Yeah, it's just, oh, they're unwanted, they're not as strong as men. Why?
Yeah.
Instead of ever say women that. Can't be sailors. It was, why would I ever have them over a man if the woman is going to be a distraction for the men?
yeah. So that, I don't know, I think that just surprised me a little bit. I was like, okay, cool.
But also, Kenneth is very pleased with everything that's going on, but his only miscalculation is Sorcor's new ties to Divytown, because when they left, Alyssum was pregnant. And Sorcor immediately wanted to go back to Divytown after other island, and Kenneth had to convince him, like, no, Sinkyor Falden was not there. He's got to know that you can provide for his daughter, so we got to get some money and pirate. And Kenneth remarks that Sorcor has a newfound fervor for that and wants to provide a lot for his new family. And once again, Kenneth is surprised at how much depth there is to Sorcor.
Right, which is so mean.
But it's them reaching the shore snaps his mind back to the task at hand, and they are on other island. They're clambering up that gravel-ish stone path, and as they disembark from that boat, he throws an arm across Etta's shoulders in mimicry of affection, as it's quoted here.
Uh-huh.
Etta and Wintrow will be coming with me. You two wait here for us. The rowers muttered uneasy agreement. The mimicry of affection. You can tell yourself that, Kenneth, and maybe you even feel that way, but everyone else does not think so because you literally just threw your arm around her shoulders.
Right. Yeah. It's, I don't know. He has some issues for sure.
Oh, yeah. Some big issues.
Right. Speaking of those issues, as they walk away from the group waiting on the rowboat, he notices that even though Wintrow looks scared, he can tell that there's excitement behind his eyes, and it makes him feel that connection with him again, that there is this part of Wintrow that is the same as young Kenneth. And it brings him back to a time when he was young and he used to get excited whenever there was a good pirate ship for the taking. And that thought sours everything immediately because...
Not a good pirate ship, like a good merchant or something. Yeah.
A good ship for piracy.
Yes.
But yeah, that thought immediately sours the whole moment because he feels as though now he's stepping into Igaret's role, and he hates that whole idea, and he feels as though he shares nothing with Igaret, and he has no fond memories of his times with Igaret.
Yeah,
all of it was bad.
He says he rejected the memory. No, he had never truly shared anything with Igaret. After all the man had subjected him to, he felt nothing for his memory except disdain. So yeah, as you were saying, he just kind of needs to remind himself that there was nothing good about his time with Igaret. Literally nothing.
Right. Which, not super healthy.
Right.
Not surprising, but not healthy to push away good memories just because they're attached to a bad person. And so he then yells, "Let's go," which makes Wintrow jump. And he leans on Etta, kind of putting more physical space between himself and Wintrow to distance from that memory, I think. And poor Wintrow, because from his point of view, he was being looked at fondly by Kennet. And then all of a sudden, Kennet grimaces and yells, "Let's go." That would be a little scary.
But Kennet definitely needs help tromping around the island, because by the time they reach the first crest of the hill, his shirt is soaked with sweat and he has to rest, and he's trying to tell himself like, oh, you know, I'm not weaker than I was before. It's just hotter than it was the first day
that
I was here. He's kind of glancing around at the forest and thinking, you know, the last time he had passed this way, the charm on his wrist had told him that there was a spell on this path to keep travelers from straying. Now, as he glanced off into the green shadows of the verdant forest, he dismissed it as so much nonsense. Who would want to stray from a straight and level path to venture through such a leafy maze? He took out his kerchief and wiped his face and neck. When he looked around, he realized the other two were waiting for him.
And he gets upset and
well,
says,
"Are you guys ready? Let's go."
Yeah, which is reminds me of something that my dad used to do all the time on trips. He'd pretend like we were the ones keeping him, even though we were waiting on him. Oh, very, very dad thing to do. But we have Kennet pushing through. And I find it really funny that he says, "Why would there need to be a ward to keep you on the path? Who would want to go out there?" Which is exactly what the path would make you think.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly what the spell that the charm told him of would make you think. Yeah. And didn't he run through the forest last time and was like trying to be trapped in there and killed on other island because he had the trinkets?
Because on the way back, isn't there the opposite of it wants you to take your time and notice things? And that's what he was doing. He was kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah, of course there's no spell. Nothing can get to Kennet.
It is, though, unclear if, because I think last time we talked about it's gravel, black gravelly stone that they're walking on. And so I think I posed the idea maybe, or maybe you did, I don't really remember, that was skill stone to help with the idea of stay on the path and keep, and it kept it level and straight. However, the others on other island can do magic or use skill, I guess. So maybe they are just chilling by the path and making people feel ways. I don't know.
I don't know either. Yeah.
Hard to know. However, they are back on the path they are going. And the second time Kennet has to stop, he decides, no, it's not because I'm weak or that it's hot. The others are tricking him.
They don't want me here. The trees seem to echo his words back in agreement. The others are making it hard for me, trying to turn me back. But I won't give up. Wintrow shall have his oracle. He lifts up his kerchief again and looks at his charm and scratches at it. Nothing happens at all, and then fakes like he was just rubbing off some dirt on it. And then says, all right, Wintrow, you can go ahead of us. We're slowing you down. You should, by the way, he doesn't mention you're slowing We're slowing you down. He says, go ahead. You should be alone so I don't taint anything, but I'm going to be there when, you know, the others read your fortune from it.
Right. Also, quick mention, specifically the reason he tries to hurt his charm is because it is sticking its tongue out at him. So
its face was frozen in a clownish smile, the mouth ajar, the tongue lolling out. It mocked him.
very funny. But yes, so he acts as though, and maybe he does believe that...
he doesn't want to taint the prophecy or yes. like prompt Wintrow to pick up anything that, you know, he wouldn't have otherwise done.
Exactly. So Wintrow goes ahead. He runs off after looking at Etta for confirmation. And when Etta shrugs, Kenna gets mad again and says, "Do you doubt me? Go." And then he runs.
Good. Kenneth put satisfaction into the word. He shook his head after him. Wintrow must learn two things from me. To obey and to be able to act on his own. Once more, he set his crutch under his arm. Follow me. Not too swiftly, for I wish Wintrow to have plenty of time alone on the beach. These things are not to be rushed. To be sure, Etta agreed. She glanced about the forest. This is a strange place. Seldom have I seen such beauty, yet it forbids itself to me. As if suddenly fearful, she moved to take his free arm. He shook his head to himself. Helpless females. He wondered why the charm had been so insistent that he bring her along. Not that he had consulted the charm about this venture. The damnable thing had insisted on offering its opinion, not once, but repeatedly. Take Etta. You must take Etta with you, it had extorted. Now look at her. He would have to take care of her, he supposed. Come along, he told her firmly. If you stay to the path, nothing will hurt you.
I think this is really important because when we come back to Etta's point of view, we learn that the reason she's doing this is because it's an easy way to help Kennet without seeming like she's helping Kennet. Right. She's actually taking a lot of his weight on. And
helping him keep balance because the gravel is shifting underneath his peg leg and it's very, very difficult to maintain balance.
But I did want to point that out because I don't think Kennet knows that. I think she
I don't think so either. Yeah.
Fully made him feel as though he is this strong, powerful person that's protecting her, and she just is a silly female that's scared. And I think
could be himself convincing himself too.
It definitely could. I just think it's interesting to again see, because I think there was another scene earlier on when she had just been added where Etta is really good at manipulating Kennet. She doesn't ever do it in a way that gives her the upper hand, really. But she does know how to work with Kennet and who he is to get him to think of her ideas as her own, as his right. own, and, you know, take over. I don't know. I've another really good example of that where from his point of view, he doesn't even catch it. And he finds himself so easy to read other people.
Well, we switch over to Wintrow's point of view, and he's running. Not from Etta and Kennet. He felt half a coward to abandon them there. He ran from the forest itself, that cupped him like a trapped mouse in its palms. He ran from the overwhelmingly strange beauty of the threatening flowers and the poignant fragrances that both tempted and repulsed him. He fled even from the whispering of the leaves set to gossiping of his death by the hot breath of the wind. He ran, his heart pounding in his chest more from fear than exertion. He ran until the path spilled out on a wide open tableland. Before him was suddenly the blue arch of sky over the open sea. A crescent beach spread out, framed at its tips by toothy cliffs. He halted, gasping for breath, wondering what he was supposed to do now. I thought that writing was pretty evocative of what was going on in his mind and pretty flowery and nice descriptors. But Wintrow goes in now to what Kennet had told him before of what to do. Basically, Kennet's saying it's simple. Just walk the beach, pick up anything that you find interesting that calls to you. Bring it to an other. It'll stick out its tongue and you put the gold on its tongue and then it'll tell you the fortunes.
Kennet also lets Wintrow in on the little secret that there is supposedly an oracle on the island, but Kennet doesn't believe it because he didn't see it when he was there last.
Mm-hmm. Some say there is an oracle, a priestess, or a captive goddess. One of those three are kind of rumors that other people say.
Right. The legend is that she knows the past, everything that has ever been. Knowing all that has gone before, she can predict the shape of the future. I doubt this is true. So I found that really interesting because we do know, obviously, as rereaders, that there is a serpent in Trapped who does know the future, or well, not the future, but the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to know how people know about that. How is there rumors of the serpent, and why would it be that the serpent can tell the future? And I don't know, but I guess the serpent's goo, I don't know, the slime that was on it is being harvested and given to the whites to
the others.
No, the others give it to the whites.
Oh,
that's what they drink in the final trilogy, with Dahlia and the little boy.
Dahlia, yeah.
Well, yeah. He drinks the serpent slime, I thought, which gives him more. It like opens his eyes to the path better, and he's more able to use the skill.
Mm.
So there are, I guess, some potencies for the whites specifically. But I wonder if it's like somebody from that town that has spread that rumor. Like, how did this get to Kenneth's ears?
I don't know. Same way that all kind of rumors are spread in general in books and fiction. It just happens because they needed to.
Yeah, fair.
I mean, it just reminds me of Pirates of the Caribbean, of the, some say that there are the Black Pearl leaves no survivors. And Captain Jack Sparrow turns to him and is like, if they leave no survivors, how do you know? How are there stories about it? You know? Uh-huh. So this reminds me of that pretty much.
Fair. So anyway, there is a rumor and Kenneth doesn't believe it.
Winter tries to pry, but Kenneth kind of says, no, you'll know what to do when the time comes. Stop. Stop doing this. You cannot depend on others to live and think for you. Winter had bowed his head and accepted the rebuke humbly. Increasingly, Kennet had said such things to him. Sometimes Winter felt the man was grooming him for something, but he was not sure what. Since Divvytown, he had accepted that there was far more to Kennet than he had ever suspected. He had followed at Kennet's heels all of one long afternoon, dragging a bag of steaks and a mallet. Kennet paced the distances and jabbed a hole with his peg where he wanted each stake driven. Some described the edges of a road, others the corners of houses. When they finished and looked back, Kennet seemed transfixed. Winter had stood beside him, trying to see what he saw. Kennet broke the silence. "Any fool can burn a town," he observed. "They say that Ygritte the Bold burned a score of towns." He gave a snort of contempt. I shall raise 100. I shall not be remembered with ashes." Wintro had accepted him then as a man of vision. And more, he was a tool of Saw.
I think that line makes me feel the most sorry for Kennet that I've felt. I don't know why, but the, like, any fool can burn down a town. I'm going to build hundreds and my name won't be associated with ashes. I don't know. It just is. It's really sad to me. And something about it is just really, it really speaks to the depth of Kennet's trauma, I guess, and what he, why he is the way that he, what he's really aiming for.
Right.
And it is ultimately a noble cause. Like, it's something to root for. But he is so deeply flawed that it's really hard to get behind that. Although, I don't know, even when you are a rereader and know the horrible things he's going to do and can see his inner working of thoughts, it's still easy to be swept up in Kennet's charm. He's such an interesting character. I think he's really well done.
Yeah, he's incredibly driven and ultimately in moments that are seemingly sincere, seemingly, you know, kind of part of who he is and what drives him, you can see that his intentions are relatively good.
Yeah.
But from his point of view, we don't know if he's like, now I'll say some stuff to make Wintro fall in love with me even more.
Right. Or that was perfectly said.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know.
You just never know.
Yeah. So I don't know. And I guess it goes back to that conversation that Vivacia and Wintrow had, right? Where Vivacia says, what does it matter if he has ill intentions if it's doing good?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at what point does it not matter as long as he's keeping all those vile things inside? I don't know. Tough call.
Well, Wintrow is here, and that's kind of all, I'll say that's kind of all we get of Wintrow's thoughts on Kennet since we last saw them together, which was months ago when Wintrow was kind of espousing him as someone you should follow. It's just the, I accepted him as a man of vision and reaffirming that he was a tool of Saw. And
right.
Saw brought them together. So
yeah,
not much.
We haven't seen his point of view since he has decided this, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep, this is the first time we've seen him since the Divvytown confrontation.
And it's kind of just breezed over, but I guess it feels natural with the amount of time that has passed and he's made the decision. And I think one thing about Wintrow is once he makes a decision, he's made it.
Yeah, and he feels better about it. I think that's what like really agonized him is being torn between two sides.
Yeah.
Well, he's kind of decided, well, I guess I'll follow Kennet's instructions, and he's wandering down the beach, keeping his eyes down, and sees nothing out of the ordinary. Just seaweed, driftwood, wildlife.
Right. This is really interesting to me. Do you remember when Kennet first walks on the beach? Did he find things right away?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. He passed things up.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was lots of little things.
So why do we think...
Magic.
Okay. Magic of editing. But yes, so Wintrow doesn't see anything, but he does, his eyes do catch on rock tidal pools, and that's something that's always called to him. So he looks behind him, notices Etta and Kennet are still nowhere to be seen, figures he has some time, and decides to go check out those tidal pools.
Mm-hmm. The isolated pools harbored anemones and sea stars. Tiny crabs scuttled from oasis to oasis. A gull came down to join him in his inspection. So he's looking at these tidal pools, kind of smiling and enjoying his time. He says the sun was warm on his back and it eased the ache in his shoulder. There were no sounds save the wind, the water, and the gulls. He had almost forgotten the simple pleasure of walking an isolated beach on a pleasant day. He did not realize he had rounded the headland until he glanced back. He could not see the beach anymore. A survey of the cliffs above him showed him that it would be death to be trapped here by an incoming tide. They rose black and sheer, except... He stepped back farther from the bluff and squinted up. There was a fissure there, or perhaps something more. A narrow, sloped trail led across the cliff's face. It was not very high, no more than the height of two men. Before he had truly considered the wisdom of it, he had started up it. So he starts up this trail, if it is a trail... Kind of sure-footed, but it's very, very narrow and doesn't seem like it was made for a man to walk up easily. So he's kind of clinging to the side of it, trying to traverse these steps up. It says one moment it seemed slippery, the next tacky, because it was underfoot was like a slime, like a sparkly slime.
Yeah. So quick question about this slime that he's climbing up. Is this like really old residue from the serpent from whenever tide comes in?
Yeah, I'm guessing like mucus or whatever is from coating the skin.
Yeah, I was also though wondering if it could potentially be from the others traveling up there. Because they probably
possible.
Have,
yeah.
They're like gooey, it seems. Just based off every description of them, I feel like they'd be gooey.
Yeah, that's definitely possible.
But also, do you think this was made to be climbed the way that Wintrow is? Obviously not by him, by men, but by the other creatures?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is the way that they go up to feed the serpent. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what the other question I had. Is there not another way in? Is it like a room
I think it's,
that they could get into through the rock?
I think it's literally this.
Oh, okay.
You walk up and I'll keep describing it here.
Yeah.
So he steps inside because he comes to a sudden indentation and steps inside and finds his way blocked by bars of metal. And he peers past them. A very narrow fissure in the rock extended all the way to the cliff top. Sunlight reached down timidly from an opening high above. Someone had chiseled and ground out a cave within it, not much larger than a coach. Inside the wrought cave, the rock floor sloped sharply away. Water from the high tide had trapped there in a dark, still pool. He could see light reflected from its surface. So I think this is literally the only way in. It's blocked by bars. There is light from above, so technically you could climb all the way to the very, very top and probably drop stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that'd be easier than this, which is only two men's height above
right
where he was on the floor. So it's not that incredibly tall.
Right. That's fair.
Something
yeah.
like 15 feet tall off the rocks below or something, you know?
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, it's, I don't know, I guess hard for me to picture this area correctly, I'm sure. So.
Yeah, it's just a cliffside that was fashioned into a bowl and yeah. a jail.
Yeah.
Around jail.
And of course, Wintro noticed it. Because I feel like if one character in this book was going to be able to see the little indentation that looked natural from the ground, it would be Wintro. He really has an eye for detail, I guess. But he is there. He is in front of the metal bars. And he starts twisting the bars just to kind of figure out what's going on, I think. He's just wondering what it's keeping out or in.
Mm-hmm.
And at the movement or the sound of the movement of the bars, something stirs in the pool.
The surface of the pool erupted. The pool was deeper than it looked to contain such a creature. Then, as it continued to regard him with immense gold eyes, he began bold enough to venture back to the bars. He clutched them in his hands and stared. The sea serpent confined in the cave was stunted, its body marked with the limits of the pool. Its head was the size of a pony. Its body was so convoluted, he could not guess the length. It was a pale yellow-green, like a glowing fungus. Unlike the scaled sea serpents he had glimpsed from the deck of the Vivacia, this one looked plump and soft as an earthworm. Its body bore thick layers of callus where it had rubbed against the rocky walls of its prison. He suddenly realized that it must have grown to fill the pool. It had been captured and confined when small. He suddenly knew that this was the only world this creature had ever known. He glanced about himself. Yes, a high tide would just reach the lip of this fissure, bringing with it new salt water. And food? He didn't think so. Someone must bring it food. It roiled in the confines of the pool, no more than a shifting of its tail from one side to the other. The effort corkscrewed its body. He watched with pity as it worked each segment of its serpentine body, trying to ease the twist on it. It could not completely. It stared at him expectantly. "So you're used to being fed," he observed. "But why are you kept here? Are you a pet? A curiosity?" So he sees this creature trapped here, and this creature has outgrown this pool a long, long, long time ago. And even trying little movements, like when he says these words, it dips his head back to the pool. It kind of twists its body and it can't untangle itself.
Right.
And so with monstrous effort, it kind of rolls over and uncoils its body a little bit more, but it ends up scraping its head against the side of the rock and then is finally able to look at him once again without that twist in its body. It's just a very, very sad scene.
Right. And Wintro is probably the best person to come upon the
someone
serpent.
Trapped in a cage.
Yeah, because he immediately decides he needs to try to help. And he goes back to working at the bars to see if he can twist them out, because they were twisting a little bit in his grip before. So he's just trying to figure out what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think this speaks to his compassion as a person. And
yeah.
despite his maybe misjudgment of Kenneth's character, he is still this young boy who is optimistic and is very compassionate, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just, like, he has a really big heart. And it does make me think a little bit, because this is the event that Amber has foreseen, that she is trying to find the nine-fingered slave boy who's going to free the serpent. This is what she wanted to be around to help her catalyst achieve. But it really makes me wonder how much Amber needs to have been there. And I guess Beloved in general, did Beloved set this path on its course? Or would this have happened regardless? Like, it could Beloved have stayed with Fitz?
Yeah, don't know. No idea.
Yeah, me either. Just a thought. But anyway,
yeah,
we have Wintrow trying to free the serpent.
He looks at the bars and he kind of follows the construction of them and tries to understand how it was made. And he sees below the bars there are very, where the bars are set into, are very worked, finely made blocks of stone and mortar that are fitted together expertly there. A slight discoloration at the edge of one suggested it might have been a slot cut in the stone, one that had been filled in to shape into the shape of the bar afterward. So he's visualizing how this cage and these bars were created and made. And once he knows how it was done, he sets to undoing it. So he takes out his knife, starts scraping away at the mortar, and is just trying as hard as he can, painstakingly, to scrape away and loosen what he can here. As he worked painstakingly, the creature watched him. From its interest, it almost seemed to know that its freedom was at stake. He gauged its girth against the spacing of the bars. At least three of them would have to come out, he guessed, and possibly four. The mortar was old and crumbly. If the mortar was his only enemy, he would have won easily. But the blocks themselves had been cut and fitted with the precision of a master. He worked until his calloused hands broke new blisters. His knees ached from the kneeling on the stone. He leaned close to the seam and blew sand and mortar out of his way. He tried his fingers in the crack. They would just slip inside. If he could get a grip, would he have the strength to lift the stone? He pulled with all his strength and thought he felt the block slide fractionally. He took up his knife and went back to work while the serpent watched him with spinning golden eyes. His injured shoulder began to ache. Do you think the serpent is making him free, the serpent? Or working some sort of glamour to encourage that? Because he sets to it pretty much immediately.
Yeah, I feel like there's definitely some influence being tried on him. However, I think regardless of that, Wintrow would have helped. So it's kind of a moot point.
Yeah.
Maybe it's trying to convey to him how they were put in. I'm sure it remembers.
I think you're on the right track, of the same as my thoughts there, that Wintrow would have tried to help, but I don't think he would have been so insistent. And later on, he looks out and sees the tide is rising again. I think if he wasn't glamored a little bit or influenced a little bit, he would have just left.
That's fair.
He's like, well, I don't want to get trapped on this island. Kenneth's going to be really mad.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I tried my best.
Yeah.
I'm out.
He also probably would have thought a little bit more about the consequences of freeing and like what that would do to whoever's keeping it captive.
Right.
And that's a moral dilemma that he would want to focus on a little bit more, I would think.
So I'm going with slightly influenced, but he is compassionate and empathetic enough to want to help to begin with. So it didn't need much nudging.
Right. Well, I think that's true of the glamour of the serpents anyway. From what we've seen, they kind of
enhance the feelings of people.
Yeah. Like, I think they don't create feelings. Although Kyle seemed to think that his feelings of hating Wintrow so bad he wanted to kill him came from nowhere. But that's debatable considering what we've seen of his thoughts of Wintrow. So although it is his kid, maybe he really wouldn't think of himself as wanting to kill his kid, but I don't know. Not convinced.
As you mentioned before, we do jump over to Etta's point of view now. And this is where she says that by taking his arm, she was able to help Kenneth as much as possible, even though they're, you know, both kind of soaked with sweat and it is very tiring.
And it's a way to not be obvious about helping him.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes she looked at what fate had done to the man and she wanted to shriek in fury. and loss. The tall, strong body that had once intimidated her was taking on a cripple's twist, as muscles on one side of his body compensated for the loss of his leg. She saw how he planned what he would do or would not do, all with an eye to keep from disgracing himself with any show of weakness. His tigerish spirit had not dwindled. His ambitions had not lessened. She only feared that the heat of the fires that drove him might consume his weakened body.
I don't love this point of view. I don't know.
I mean, Etta is not a very good person either.
Yeah, fair enough. I don't know. It just feels like a little unnecessary, I guess. And I hate that that's all she sees is the shell of the man that used to be, when it's still kind of, and he's still basically the same. I don't know. It's hard. I don't know how to talk about this in a way that will convey what I mean to say without it coming across wrong.
Well, in 2024 terms, this is, you know, very ableist, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But from her point of view, she has grief for what could have been and what she saw and originally fell in love with and was her protector, right?
Right.
So seeing that and having her stepping up to the role of helping him feels like, oh man, what could have been? Like, right. Yeah, I still love this man, and he's still a wonderful, incredibly intelligent, and the guiding light of my life and whatever, but I have to help him physically sometimes.
Yeah, and I think the part that I don't like versus the parts that I do, like, I do understand the sadness of what could have been, and obviously his life has been changed by losing his leg. I think that's very real. However, I don't love the whole, I feel as though his new weakness would be consumed by the fire of his spirit. It's like,
yeah.
Really? It's not, it's a leg missing, half of a leg missing. It's not, it is a big deal. I don't want to make it seem like a disability isn't a big deal, but not in the way that she's talking about it.
Right.
And so I think that makes me frustrated, because I'm like, mm-hmm. Okay, well, he's still a human being. And yes, it's sad.
Is Kenneth a human being?
I mean, fair. I mean,
he works miracles, so I don't know.
Oh my God. I will say it is sad that Kenneth has to spend so much more time deciding what to do and what not to do based off of pride. Like, that is annoying, number one, to need to worry about all the time. But number two, like, that is a sad thing to see a loved one have to deal with that you cannot help them through.
Right.
But I don't know. Outside of that, it's kind of like, okay, Etta, it's still kind of, he just has to do things a little differently now. And that's fine. So anyway, she is miffed, but this whole area is kind of crazy. It's magical and interesting and different.
Mm-hmm. They reach the beach and do not see any sign of Wintrow anywhere. The curved shoreline was black sand and rock backed by the tableland. There was nothing large enough to conceal him. Where could he be? She blinked her eyes against the glare of sun on the water. Could he have walked the beach already? Would the others have met him and taken him somewhere? I don't know, Kenneth growled. He lifted his arm and pointed to the far end of the beach, where a separate finger of land separated itself from the shore. Down there is the alcove cliff, where all the treasures are kept on display. If he walked the beach and met an other, it might take him there to deposit whatever he had found. Damn. I should have been there with him. I wanted to hear what the creatures would say to him. She thought he would blame her then, accuse her of dawdling on the path or otherwise delaying him. Instead, he settled his crutch under his arm and nodded at the alcove rock. Help me get there, he growled. She kind of makes some quick calculations that, you know, the tide is about to come in. It really would be better if she was sent off running ahead to see if he was there and come back rather than helping Kenneth cross everything. And she says she nearly spoke out. Then she straightened her spine and took Kenneth's arm. He knew all these things as well as she did. He had said to help him get there. She would.
A lot of trust put in Kenneth. And we see a little bit of growth or depth added to their relationship in that she still expects him to be a jerk to her, even though it's just the two of them here. And she's waiting for that blame. And he doesn't blame her,
mm-hmm.
which does a little bit feel out of character. Maybe not out of character, just unique, I guess, because we know that normally he's thinking in his head, oh, that woman, she's awful.
Well, I mean, that's also how she grew up, though, is with a lot of people blaming her. Like, this is not just her relationship with Kennet. This could be carried baggage that she's had for a long time. And just how she grew up in Divvytown.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, yeah, Kennet would also berate her for things. But right. I'm saying it's not probably just him.
Right. No, so, that's a good point.
Growing as a person in general, but also in the relationship a little bit.
And also seeing that on her point of view, there's a lot less pushback to Kennet, I guess. I feel everybody in general just kind of does whatever Kennet wants. But there's still that acknowledgement of, oh, I don't know if that's the right decision. However, a lot more trust and faith being put into him to make decisions and that he ultimately knows what's best, mm-hmm. regardless of what it seems.
But also, like, that's all great. And I understand, like, great, we talked about that. But the other angle of this is what we talked about 5 minutes ago, mm-hmm. where it's her ableist take of, she literally says, it would make more sense for her to run ahead and see if Wintrow was there first instead of forcing Kennet to lurch the length of the beach.
Yeah.
It's coming out of a sense of like, hey, this would be more efficient. But in her mind, it's like, well, he's just gotta, he's really slow.
Yeah, he's
gotta help
him
there if we do this.
Yeah.
And it's Kennet's side is, I can't show any weakness. So, I mean, yeah, still mm-hmm. trusting, and they're kind of working together. And
yeah.
She's believing in Kennet's choice in this and enabling him to be, you know, keep his pride.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it is big of Kennet to ask for help because he doesn't typically do that. But maybe he realized that he could go faster if he does that. And I think, I guess I'm sure we'll touch on it when it gets there, but she is shocked when he can run. And it's like, yeah, girly, like, I don't know what to tell you. He's like, again, just lost half a leg and he is wearing a prosthetic. So not that that means that running is eminent or like it has to be a thing. I don't know.
We jump back over to Wintrow's point of view here and he is still working. The backs of his hands were scraped and bleeding and his arm was throbbing by the time he lifted the first block from its bed. It had been heavier than he expected, but the tight fit had been the biggest obstacle. He finally kind of shoves it out of the way with his foot and stands up, arching his aching back and gripping the bar in both hands. He lifts it. Eventually, he's able to kind of lift and lift and lift. And finally, when it kind of falls out of his hands, it goes back to the stone and not in the hole. So then he's able to kind of wedge it out. So one bar down. It says, don't get your hopes up as the serpent lashes its tail. So transparent lids briefly covered the great gold eyes when he gets the one bar down.
Mm-hmm.
It lifted its head from the water and shook it. A fleshy starburst suddenly bloomed around its throat. When it twisted in the water, he now saw a faint pattern ran the length of its body. The variation in color reminded him of the eyes on a peacock's tail. He abruptly wondered if the display meant it was angry. Perhaps it felt threatened by what he did. The poor creature had probably been confined here all its life. Maybe it thought he threatened its lair. So Wintrow still doesn't understand that serpents are sentient and probably more intelligent than he is, which, you know, fair.
Yeah.
But also we know that this pattern along the body are the false eyes that Mercor also has. And it's just kind of a pattern to show that this person holds a little bit more memories than the normal person.
Right.
Serpents, I mean. Next time the water rises, you'll be able to go free if you want to. He spoke the words aloud, knowing they were just noises to it. It probably couldn't even interpret the reassuring tone of his voice. He knelt and went to work on the next block. So this one goes much faster because the first one's gone now. So he's kind of got his process down and the mortar is also, you know, crumbly and old so he can scrape away and he's getting everything good. And the second one was looser than the first. So metal shrieked against the stone and mortar rained down once more, and it suddenly came to Wintrow that perhaps someone would be angry with what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And maybe the noise could attract attention.
Yes.
So he gets the second bar out and then walks outside for a brief look.
Yes, just to see what's going on, which does raise the question, where are the others? Are they just watching this, waiting to see what happens?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Because they do end up running to the beach after the serpent is freed. Mm-hmm. But where are they right now? Why wouldn't they come to...
Maybe they were more focused on Kenneth. Because he was there before, and he has the charm, and he took things off the island.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a little bit more distracting, and he's kind of there right in front of them, walking slowly through the forest, where they're like, you can only come here once, and you can't take anything off, and then
he's back.
He's back, and he took things off.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, fair enough. Interesting.
So that's my thought on it, at least.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
And, you know, Wintrow went around the... You know, the rocks, didn't find anything on the beach, because I expect people are kind of staring at the beach most of the time when they go there, because there's cool things.
Right.
Wintrow didn't see anything, and he just kind of wandered to the...
tidal pools.
Yeah, and then walked around the headland. So yeah. It was kind of around the corner.
That's fair, yeah. So, also a little bit sad that Wintrow missed out on all the cool finds. Although, can you just imagine if this didn't happen and he did walk the beach like he was supposed to, and... And he, like, found even one weird thing. I don't think he would be able to move on. He'd be too stuck marveling at the grace of Saw.
Right.
That, like, had been given to him to see this with his eyes. And I don't know. Maybe Saw is real and kept things away from that beach.
So Wintrow peeks his head out of the fissure. There's no one in sight, but another threat was immediately visible. The tide had turned and was creeping back in over the stones. There were storm clouds on the horizon. The wind seemed to be blowing the tide in with its force. Bladderwort had lain flat on the rock, now swayed with the incoming water. The rising tide could trap him here. Even if it did not, there were other matters to consider. The treasure beach, the oracle, and the boat that was expecting them to return by high tide. Kennet was probably furious with him. He stood, cradling his sore arm, and watched the tide spilling up over the slope of the beach. It was coming fast. He had no control at all over that one factor. If he stayed, he was going to be trapped here. As it was, he was going to get wet waiting around the headland. He'd have to leave. He'd done all he could. He heard a sound from within the fissure, a metal bar rolling on stone. Frowning, he stepped back within and then gasped at what he saw. It had heaved itself out of the pool and flung itself at the walls of its prison. Its head, turned sideways, was wedged in the opening he had created. Its dwarfed and twisted body was still powerful as it lashed and thrust against the confines of the pool. "No, go back," he cried futilely. "It's too small. There's no water yet." It could not understand him. The animal lunged again against the bars, but only succeeded in wedging itself more tightly. It screamed its frustration. The starburst around its head, its neck standing out as it raged. It tried to jerk its head back through the bars, but could not. It was stuck. With a sinking heart, he realized he was stuck as well, because Wintrow could not leave it like that. Its gills worked frantically as its gasping jaws. He did not know how long it could survive with its head out of the water. There was already an air of desperation to the lashing tail. If he could just loosen one more bar, perhaps it could slip back into the pool. It wouldn't be free, but it wouldn't be dead. If he hurried, he might live too. And so he approaches gingerly and starts to work.
Right. And this is kind of scary because this is a wild animal and he's not sure that it has any intelligence. So he's worried, even in the worst or the best of times, wild animals will bite or non-wild animals will bite. So in this situation where it's trapped and scared, potentially, he's just hoping that he doesn't get hurt, because a normal wild animal biting would be bad. This would leave little less.
Yes. And thankfully, with its thrashings, it had loosened another block, but it had coated it with its slime. It wasn't going to make lifting any easier, he thinks. So he takes up one of the bars he'd worked loose. It was horribly long, but at least he wouldn't have to touch it. And he uses the bars as a lever to kind of push the block out of the way. He shoved the freed bar between the two remaining bars and used it as a lever. Unfortunately, this meant pushing the bar even tighter against the creature. It roared, but surprisingly it did not strike at him. The block of stone that secured the bar at the base grated against its fellows as it shifted. Wintrow immediately repositioned his lever in the widening crack between the blocks. The pole was too damn long. It jammed against the walls of the fissure, but finally it worked, shoving the stone over a bit. Now, for the bar that was still standing that he had to get out of the grate yet.
Yes. He then warns, "Don't hurt me," or asks, I guess, "Please, yes. Don't hurt me," and notes that the creature seems to understand the tone of his voice, if not the intent.
Or maybe it's just dying.
Yeah.
He doesn't know, but it's calm.
Yeah, it is not attacking. So he goes and is immediately filled with pain.
Yes, he seized the bar in his hands and lifted it up. He screamed. His hands burned and froze to the slime-coated metal. But the agony on his skin was as nothing compared to the agony of knowing. He knew her pain, and he grasped suddenly the torment of a sentient creature imprisoned for the time past his ability to imagine. With her, he breathed the scalding air. Her tender skin cracked and stung in the dryness, while he knew with terror that soon it would be too late. She must escape now, or it would soon be too late for all of them. He convulses away from the bar. The strength of his body's rejection of the pain flung him to the floor of the prison. He says that nothing had ever prepared him for that level of sharing, not even the clumsy bond that he had with the live ship. For a brief moment, he had been unable to distinguish him between himself and the creature.
So I want to quick do a little chat about this bond or this connection. Is this wit related or skill related?
Dragon related. I don't know. That's as best as I can say.
Fair enough. I'm just thinking about all the descriptions we get from Fitz's point of view when he bonds with Night Eyes or any other animal, versus whenever he is sharing a mind with Verity, or whenever he accidentally skills out to people and shares their body because they've called out to him during the Red Ship Wars. And I feel as though this is closer to the wit bond. And
I think it's very similar to the skill where he like joins the Red Ship War people.
Yeah, where they are one.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what happens in the wit bond whenever you
sometimes
become a part, like
that's why I say it's a dragon thing, you know. It's enough, a little combination of both.
It could be. But the reason I bring this up is because I think during the first book of this trilogy I asked if the ship bonding with
was the, wit or skill,
what that's through. And so because this is a creature, a being that feels like it'd be wit bonded, I guess. And therefore the shadow of that being the soul of the creature, not the physical creature itself.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Interesting.
Just a thought I had. Although maybe that leans more towards it being skill over wit. Or maybe you're right. Maybe it's a secret third option.
Well, he's thinking to himself with this sudden new knowledge, and he's like, no, this is not a creature. Not unless he too was to be considered a creature. She was no less than he was. As he considered all he had experienced, he wondered if she was more. An instant later, he was on his feet, and he tore off his shirt and wrapped it around his hands and approached the bar again. This time, he had to recognize the intelligence that was fading in the great gold eyes. He seizes the bar again, lifts. It was difficult because the coating made it slippery. He heaved up on it twice before he lifted it from the deep bed in the stone. The moment it had cleared the lip of the block, the sea serpent surged against it. Her greater bulk pushed it aside as if it were straw. Wintrow went with it, not only flung forcefully aside by her passage, but also brushed with the slick coating of her scaled hide. It seared him where it touched his flesh. He cried out as he saw even his heavy canvas trousers fraying away like crumpling ashes. He knew her determined intent. It appalled him. "No water below!" He conveyed the information with voice and thought as forcefully as he was able. "Rocks, only rocks, you'll die. Death is preferable." She thinks at him. And she goes out. She's undulating past him. As she passed, he was aware of the tremendous effort it took for her to move her cramped and distorted body. This was an act of desperation. She was not sure if she fled to freedom or death, but she knew she left captivity behind. Yes, sorry to have killed you. It's all right, he muttered. He was not even sure if he was dead. He was outside of himself. No, bigger than himself. It was like the trances at the monastery, when he worked his stained glass, but bigger, much bigger. The pain of his scalded flesh was no more significant than an annoying splinter in his heel. Ah, he sighed. Now I see you clearly. You were there all along. The serpents and the dragons in my windows, in all my art. How did you know I'd come to you? How did you know to come to me? She wondered in reply. But she did not wait for an answer and just goes out.
So this was what I wanted to come back to from the beginning when we had the little chat about Wintrow seeing the green serpent behind his eyes or serpent-like shape.
Yeah.
Wriggling.
I read that sentence a couple times and it's like the light snaked through like a serpent.
Mm-hmm. And this is a green serpent.
Right.
Well, it's more...
You like yellow green.
Yeah, but you know... But
a chartreuse.
It is a greenish serpent. And apparently in this heightened state, this connection to the skill state, as I would like to call it, Wintrow recalls knowing that this would happen all along and being able to really put the pieces together of his art. This is what it was calling him to.
Yeah, he's also falling into delusions because then he thinks that he is the serpent a little bit later. So,
no, definitely there is a little bit of, it is a grain of salt.
I wouldn't call it lucid thoughts at this point.
But I don't know, this might be closer to real because I think at this point he's not that close to death. He's definitely in danger, but
yeah.
I think he's just more connected with a skill stream or whatever is going on.
Right. Yeah. He's not really in his mind and his body right now.
Yeah. And so, and especially with how he talks and how he talks about being so much bigger than himself and having much more knowledge, which is what Fitz always says whenever he gets lost in the stream, is that you just are so connected to everything and it feels so good to know, like you just know everything. And here we have that, and it's actually connected to a coherent thought, I guess, that we as readers can understand, which I don't think we really get outside of this example usually.
Right.
So I found it interesting, and I was wondering if you thought at all if they're connected or if that really was him foreseeing that he would come to help this being.
He's more, I mean, with the talk of, you know, destiny and oracles and predestination, that sort of thing, I think it's more of like, oh, this was the plan for my destiny and fate all along. Mm-hmm. This is where I was supposed to end up. Not necessarily like you led me here, and not necessarily, this is, I don't know. It feels like he's just drawing dots and like connecting the dots through his life. It's like, oh, everything I've done led me to this moment.
Yeah.
That's great. Which like in the skill stream, you know, that's what the dragon believes or the serpents believe. And that's, you know, kind of what he's inundated with, you know, his connection to her right now. So he's believing that as well.
Although that's also the fate that Beloved saw for him.
Right.
So maybe it is his destiny. Maybe it is all connected. Maybe Saw is real. I don't know.
Ooh, well, I think we will stop there. This is a long chapter and there's a lot going on.
There is.
A lot back to back to back here. So I think we'll pause there for now and dive kind of immediately back in where we left off.
Yeah.
Next week. So sorry for the cliffhanger here, for the cutoff.
Sorry, guys.
But we'll jump back in. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please let us know if you have any thoughts on this chapter so far, if you have any theories or anything you want to say about our thoughts on things, any commentary. Send in your pet picks, your pet theories, and let us know what's going on in your life. We're at isfitshappy@gmail.com, or you can message us on any of our social medias, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Reddit, YouTube. Isfitshappy at all of those.
Yeah, and we had a lot of tinfoil hat theories, so we look forward to hearing what you guys think of those.
Yeah.
See you next week.